This is Van Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Ray Lauk. How are you doing today?
Doing great, Phantom. Thanks for having me.
It's always interesting to talk to new people. I want to let people know that this is episode 1058 of our program, Tracking That on Apple Podcasts since 2016. And you can also see that we've got your link up, rlauk.com, and I'll be fully clickable for those of you who want to click on that. You won't have to worry about it. You won't have to remember that. You'll be able to click through on that. And today we're going to talk to you because we're going to talk about the topic of sharing the magic storytelling for leaders. And that applies to, I think, to everybody, not just leaders, but we'll talk about that. But one of the things we like to talk about before we really get into it is like, what motivates you and why do you do what you do? And you have a couple of different hats. So I don't know where you want to start with. I know you're a professor, you're a stand-up comedian. You've got a lot of other things you do in terms of author. So I don't know where you want to start with those questions.
Sure. Well, I think I kind of evolved into storytelling. I started off being a school superintendent in the Chicago suburbs. And I always had heard of Second City Theater and knew about Second City Theater. You know, so many of our comics and comedians have come through Second City. So since I was just, you know, 12, 15 miles away from the city, I started to take classes at Second City. And I went through the beginning improv program. And I loved it. It was life-changing. I had the most amazing teachers. It was just wonderful, except for one thing. I was never fully comfortable with improv comedy. One of the big advantages or the things that I got out of Second City and the improv was trying to get out of my head and try to just be in the moment and all of that stuff. But I found that I didn't like being as surprised as the audience hearing what was coming out of my mouth at the same time. So I kind of moved over, but I did the year-long program and had fun, learned a lot. But then I thought, so then I would try stand-up because, you know, stand-up is largely a writing process. I mean, yeah, you're on stage, you're delivering, there's timing, but it's largely about writing. And so I would write and rewrite jokes, and I morphed into stand-up comedy. The first place I tried stand-up was in Tampa, Florida, because I didn't know anyone there. Because if I bombed, which I did, and that's kind of almost a certain, that's just part of the process of doing stand-up is being terrible. And sure enough, I was terrible at it. But I think it's an experience that everyone should have, standing up in front of the world and saying, here's what's funny, and having absolutely no one laugh. It's a humbling experience, but it's a great experience that everyone should have. But the club that I was at, and I believe it was Side Splitters, if I'm not mistaken, the manager at the time pulled me back afterwards and he said, Ray, would you like some feedback? And I said, sure. And so he showed me his laptop. He showed me how he structured his jokes. It was a great learning experience. And I did that for a while, but and actually I also did stand up in Rio de Janeiro even, because I speak Portuguese badly. But it was interesting because when I went to Rio and did stand up as the international component, the international guest for this group called Comédia em Pé, they gave me 5 minutes and I got more laughs than anywhere else. And afterwards I told these guys, I said, they liked my jokes, didn't they? He said, no, it was your Portuguese they were laughing at.
Oh, that's
so, so it was not my comedy, but it was the Portuguese.
It was the way you did it.
Yeah. So I did that for a while, did stand up for a while. And then I morphed into storytelling because at Second City Theater, this was before the pandemic and all that. They would offer one of the theaters on Sunday mornings that otherwise would be dark to the community. And so in the first thing in the morning, I think it was storytelling. And then a couple hours later, then it was stand-up. And so that's how I kind of got my start doing storytelling. And I just found it much easier because, you know, this is the lesson for everyone. Everyone's got a story. You cannot get it wrong. But having the improv background and the story and the stand-up background helped make my stories more engaging, more interesting. You know, they're not required to be humorous, but a lot of times humor gets in there. And so one process, one art form built upon each other until the point that I was at storytelling. So that's kind of how I got into it.
That's really interesting because a lot of things are kind of like taking from multiple elements. Like a lot of times when you're in the creative space, like the fact that you merged some of the aspects of stand-up comedy and the kind of improv and then storytelling, because every comic, as you said, from the Richard Pryors to all the great comics, is they write their bits. I mean, it's not just totally made up. You have people right. that do that made up, but you have to craft it. Like, you know, a songwriter crafts a song, and over time you might evolve the song based on feedback. Like you get that's the right. audience feedback, and you learn what works. Oh, this note works. This phrase works. You get that. What I like, I think, is that we might have in common is musicians and people who go on stage, that audience feedback is really important, because it kind of, if you pay attention to, you know, you read the room, right, then you know how to kind of massage your work to kind of fit the moment.
Yeah. And the feedback is instant and it's unfiltered. You know immediately if you're hitting it or if you've just missed it completely.
Totally missed it. And so it's like that. So I guess the thing I like about the kind of improvisational stuff is like, if you're living in that moment and you're willing to hear and read the room, that you don't just stay on your plan. Right. And that might be hard, because like if you're somebody that's like, well, I got to stay to what I wrote rather than like a fusion jazz, I can evolve it. There's no bad note. I can actually hear a different note than what was planned and go a different direction and kind of feel the vibe of the room. So is that a problem, given the fact that you maybe don't like the improv? Is it harder for you to kind of evolve that way at the moment?
Well, when you're doing storytelling, there are kind of two ways you could go. The one way is to write it out and read your story. And the other way is just off the top of your head as you recall it and as you remember it. And I've always liked to read my stories because I feel I'm a better writer than a memorizer. Mm-hmm. However, there are some rooms that want you completely off book and they just want it to hear it come out of your mouth without having memorized it or without reading it. And I've become a little more comfortable doing that lately. It's interesting. I host a storytelling show, a monthly show on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University where I teach, where I'm an associate professor. And most of my students who do the storytelling all are off book. And I always give them the choice, but it's kind of interesting because almost all of them will just come and tell their story as they remember it. And mm-hmm. I think there is something to the freshness, and it's like it's one-on-one. It's like you're having a conversation with the audience instead of talking at them and reading them. So I'm moving more towards that improvised storytelling process.
It's interesting the way art is, because a lot of times, like, you know, you start to trust yourself in terms of like, you could tell a story, but every time you tell it, you might tell it a little different. There's a story about Bob Dylan, and I'm really been to Bob Dylan, but like when he did like Blood on the Tracks, there's some key tracks from that when he would do the live version, he would change the story. He would, like, when he would do Idiot Wind, he would actually change verses in it. And depending on when you saw him, he would choose different verses. And it's not like he was doing it from like making it up. He had different versions of the song. And depending on how he felt that day, he would actually run with a different variation.
Well, you bring up a really good point about storytelling, because I work with businesses who, in particular with sales people, who are trying to be more engaging with an audience, with a potential client or a customer. Or I also do a lot of work with school boards, because public education is kind of my background. And I always tell them, the good news is, first of all, you can't get it wrong, because it's your story. It's your true personal experience. But the other thing is, you don't need 1,000 different stories. If you have a handful of well-crafted stories, you can modify them and adapt them for different purposes. Kind of my signature story that I usually open up my workshops with is the experience of being a student teacher in Boulder, Colorado, back in 1982. And my supervising teacher was in his probably in his late 60s, maybe early 70s, still teaching sixth grade. And parents loved him, kids loved him, the administration hated him. He was quirky. He was a character, let's say, crusty character maybe. And I'll just give you enough of the story to explain how I can massage it and go different ways. But he was a real character. He always had one of those kind of a gray windbreaker jackets that I always remembered my grandfather always wearing. His name is Monty. He always smoked Virginia Slims cigarettes. And the day that I started student teaching, he walked out and said, "If you need me, kid, I'll be in the teacher's lounge." And in 1982, that teacher's lounge would be the smoker's teacher's lounge, too. And he drove a 1959 Ford Edsel that was kind of one of those reddish, bleached out colors, you know, faded from decades of the Colorado sun. But I would, you know, most of the time he was smoking in the lounge. And every now and then he'd come in and out of the classroom. Well, I was so obsessed with what was going on with these kids, and we're doing mini society, teaching economic concepts and all sorts of learning that was going on. And it was just so exciting. It was my first week with real kids in a real classroom that I really didn't pay attention to him in and out. But he was in and out. And what I didn't realize was he was making taking everything in. And when I learned that was the following Saturday at the end of the week. I was exhausted from all this teaching. But Saturday morning, 6 a.m., my phone rings and it's Monty. And I say, "Hello." And he says, "Raymond." I said, "Yes." "Monty, is everything okay?" Because this was kind of unusual. He said, "Yes, I was just wondering something." I go, "What's that?" He said, "Do you remember on Tuesday, Jason came in and asked you a question?" I said, "Well, that was kind of a few days ago. I really don't remember." He said, "Well, he asked you how your weekend was. Even though it was Tuesday, he asked you how the weekend was." I said, "Okay, I vaguely kind of remember that." And then Monty said, "Do you remember what you told him?" I said, I guess I told him it was an okay weekend." And then there was silence. And then he just said, "You jackass. You completely missed the point of what that interaction was. Jason didn't care about your weekend. Don't you know his parents are splitting up? Dad's already in Detroit, moved out of the house, out of the state. Maybe, just maybe, he was looking for a little male attention." I was like, I had missed that completely, Monty. And Monty's point was that every interaction with a child, even as fleeting and apparently insignificant, is an opportunity to deepen and extend the relationship with that student. And so Monty gave me literally 3 hours of the most insightful feedback on my teaching based on those little glimpses when he'd be in and out of the classroom, usually getting more cigarettes out of his desk. And then he took a breath after a while, after 3 hours, and he said, "Ray, I'm out of beer." Because he had been drinking beer from the time he dialed my number at 6 a.m.
Wow.
He said, "If you're not doing anything, Would you mind stopping at North Boulder Liquors and picking up a case of Schlitz Tall Boys and bringing it over? I'm a student teacher. I didn't, you know, this was like the other duties as assigned. So I got dressed and went to the liquor store, picked up the Schlitz Tall Boys, brought it to his house. And we drank beer, well, Schlitz, for another 3 hours as I got the most insightful feedback on my teaching. Then after 3 hours, he says, let's make some toffee candy now. Now, I tell that story, and I added that last part for a reason. I mean, it's all true. But if I'm speaking to new teachers, I tell the story with the lesson of every interaction with a child is an opportunity to extend and deepen that relationship. But with a little tweaking, that story can also be perfect for talking about mentoring and an intergenerational thing. I was 22 years old. Monty was in his 60s or 70s. So there was also a story that could be used about a mentoring relationship. If I'm speaking to entrepreneurs or business people, I use that story to talk about how I got into the toffee making business, which I'm not doing today, but I had been doing toffee. And the toffee candy was Dr. Ray's Toffee. And that's another web. The website is still up there, but there's nothing to sell and nothing to buy because I haven't done it since I came to Kentucky. But that one story can go three different ways. Wow. And so that's why I share it that way. And I also am very intentional about the kinds of details. And that's why I talk about the color of the car, the age, the windbreaker, the brand of cigarettes, the brand of beer. Because those are all the details that kind of fill in the color to the story and give people, the listeners, hooks on mm-hmm. which to latch onto, to make it relate to them. Because you never know who or in the audience is going to relate to a particular aspect or a particular detail. That's why you try to fill in as many details as you can. Something for everyone.
Well, I think it's really interesting because it's the same kind of thing that songwriters will do. It's like you're trying to create that sound painting or the visual cinematic world that you get brought into when you tell a story. So yeah. When you tell a story, if you're a songwriter and you know, classic is Dylan, like he tells these stories. These really long, elaborate, you know, very detailed stories where he gives the detail that you're talking about, right. The color of the car, or talking about what somebody's eating or what they're, all the little minute details that an author would, like if you're reading a great American novel or a great epic poem, it's like, it's very important to get those, the colors, the vibe. The feel, like when you say the Edsel, it's like, wow, you know, Edsel wasn't a bestseller. Like I'm into cars, like when I was like a failure. So they have a Edsel walk driving around on the Edsel. That's very quirky. It kind of emphasizes the quirkiness of the character of your mentor. And I'm like, wow, you kind of get a picture in my mind. I get this picture, you know.
Yeah. And for most people, they probably don't even know what a Ford Edsel looks like, but you're a car aficionado. So that was a hook. And I didn't know that about you, but that was a hook. That was a detail that was meaningful to you that brought you in. And there are kind of two levels of story development and storytelling, I think. And when I do training, and I do a lot of training with school board members, I've been doing a pre-conference workshop of storytelling for school board members for the last 3 years. And I also do it with business people too. And so I, you know, not trying to do an English lesson, but in terms of storytelling, I try to get people to think of the details, to think of the tension or the conflict. There's usually some kind of conflict, and then kind of work their way through that, and the resolution ultimately, kind of the, you know, how it all ends up and what the lesson is. But that's sort of the skeleton of the story, and then from there, we go back and we start with like a 3-minute story, just rolling it out. But then later we come back and think of the five senses and fill in details. And that's filling in the color to the story, those hooks. What did you see? What did I see? What are those images? Any tastes? What did things sound like? What do they look like? What did we feel? Were we, what emotions were there? And so that's how we expand the story and really make it memorable with those details. That's the key, I think. And that's why I always trick my audiences, because then at the very end of the session, and it might be 2 to 3 hours later, I test them and I ask them, what was my supervising teacher's name? What kind of beer did he drink? What cigarettes did he smoke? What was the grade? All those details that I had filled in innocently, that appeared to be innocent details. And then afterwards, I asked them those test questions, and invariably they remember. They may not remember all of those details, but they do remember aspects that they related to, that were meaningful to them. And then the lesson. And again, that lesson, or what the learning was, is adapted for that particular audience.
Yeah, it's just really interesting. You color the story with the details, and people, the audience, you never know what audience is going to actually take away. You might have a planned lesson learned, but once you put a story out there or a song out there, the audience kind of owns it, and they kind of put into what they feel. And if you've done it in a well crafted way, there's a high level lesson learned that everybody will kind of see. And then there may be subtext that are maybe harder to find. And I guess when you're dealing with business people, teaching them how to tell stories, like a lot of business people, they want to orient like an elevator pitch story. Yeah. Or they want to get the sales pitch story. They want to get somebody to be interested in their brand. So like their bottom line is, oh, I want these lessons or these key points to be what's easily understood. So when you're teaching somebody like that, there's probably different parameters that you go through, right?
Yeah. I'll give you three examples quickly of stories that I remember from some of these workshops that we've done. Two of the stories come from school board members who have talked about why they ran for the school board, what they want to accomplish as a school board member. One of them told the story, and I'm not giving out any confidences because they were all publicly shared. But one was a 26-year-old individual who is now the vice president of a school board in the Western United States, one of the largest cities in the country. And he talked about when he was in high school, 16, 17 years old, he used to break into school buses in the bus barn. Now, Phantom, can you guess why he would be breaking into school buses?
I don't know. Just trying to find what the kids left in the bus. I don't know.
No, that's where he slept. He was kicked out of his house. That's where he slept. He was sleeping on the school buses as a 16-year-old. 10 years later, he is the vice president of that board of education. What a story of turning around his life and the family dynamics and all that. Another school board member in a Midwestern large city. When he was out campaigning for the school board, he was shot by a gun. And he felt that his service as a school board member was so important to his community that you talk about risking your life. He was risking his life to do that. Now, what I tell people in the storytelling training is the good news is you don't have to sleep on buses. You don't have to get shot. Most of us don't have these stories of the time we lifted the car off a child and saved the child's life. We live normal, everyday lives with lots of small, routine kinds of situations. The good news is those situations are ones that all of us can relate to, and that's what makes it golden, is because it's because our little situations of everyday life are things that we can relate to. And so you can craft a well-developed story around something that's almost trivial, but where you learn something. The third story, I mentioned three stories. The third one is one of our students here at Eastern Kentucky University, where I didn't know him in advance. We met through email. He was referred to me, and he walked into the room where we had the show. And I could tell there was something about him that he was a little uncomfortable. He was unsure of where he was at. And sure enough, he was on the autism spectrum. But he was my storyteller. And so once we got him relaxed, and when he was sitting there, he was kind of experiencing some of the behaviors that you typically see on the autism spectrum. And it was his turn to come up and tell a story. And he got up, and all of those behaviors melted away. It was remarkable. And he told the story of how he had attempted college earlier at other places. He was a little older than most college freshmen or sophomores. But he had resigned himself to the fact that he was going to live life alone because of being autistic. And he was fairly severely autistic. He shared that. But once he came to this university and to this campus, he, for the first time in his life, has friends. And that he didn't feel that he was going to go through life alone anymore because of that. And it was such a powerful movie experience. I mean, people in the audience, the way he described it and told his story was far more emotional than I may have been able to communicate it. But it was, I mean, people were almost in tears listening to this. And then he finished his story and sat down, and you could see the autistic behaviors kind of came back. But for those 5 or 6 minutes that he was on stage, he was in a different place. He was in a different world. And the thing that I tell my storytellers is, you never know who you're going to help. You never know who in the audience is going through some of the same things that you are. But invariably, you're always helping someone. You never know who, but you always are. I had another storyteller who was an Asian student who felt that he was not living up to his parents' Asian expectations, which were exceptionally high. And he warned us that there were some potential triggers here for some members in the audience, but he talked about the first time he attempted suicide and failed at it, and the second time he attempted suicide. And there might've been a third time even. That's when he reassured us he was okay, he received whatever therapy, but he was doing well. But there was a situation where you never know in the audience, somebody may, especially a college audience, mm-hmm. college students, yeah. of these kids who may have challenges of living up to parents' expectations or self-imposed expectations. But that hearing that story of another student who lived through that and was facing some pretty serious challenges, that if they can make it, the audience member can make it too. So that's the power of stories, is sharing those lessons learned and helping other people, because you'll always do.
I think it's a really important way I've learned over the time we've been talking to people on this podcast is, you know, people will be constrained by imposter syndrome, or they're constrained by the, you know, the expectations of their parents, and then they get reinforced with like an imposter syndrome. But what I try to let everybody know is, like, everybody's story is why I'm here. Like, I allow people to tell their story, and every, you know, even though something might not seem like it's a big deal, like it could be a big deal to you. And if you don't tell that story, it may not be the biggest event in the world, but it could, once you put that story into the universe and it's like your experience is put out there, it tends to help other people because it resonates. And it's kind of like the central theme of like this idea of a key like a universal key, like or vibration, right, or a frequency. Sometimes when we talk, we can hit that key with what we, yeah, said, and then it resonates. And just like a musician hitting a note, you're that point you make with that resonate, it resonates through the room. You have no idea who it's going to activate or what, right, thoughts it's going to, you know, trigger. But it's very important to not just keep that to yourself. I've always been a big, yeah, purveyor of, like, there's nothing wrong with it telling your story.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what we discovered through the process of hosting this story, or the show, is that 3 years ago we started it. And every month we had 6 to 8 storytellers come up, tell their story. Usually they brought the audience. I mean, we started with an audience of 4 people. There were more people on the stage than in the audience. Mm-hmm. But we started and they told these brilliant stories, but they were lost forever unless you were in the audience. Mm-hmm. Then the second year, we started to record those for a podcast. And those are all now published on or housed on Spreaker.com. And if you just search Talking Out of School, you can find the repository of our stories now. And then last year, the third year, I had a grant from the university, and we were able to expand it to video as well. So, and the reason that we started to record those was because we realized that these are the stories of our students. And I'll just give a little plug here at Eastern Kentucky University. We are a school of opportunity. We serve students who are, almost half of our students are first generation students. Many of them come from our service region, being Eastern Kentucky, the Appalachian region. And if you may recall, a year and a half ago, so a year ago in July, there were the huge floods, tragic floods, mm-hmm, where so many of our families lost lives, lost everything they ever owned. A lot of them, I mean, were living in very modest residences. I mean, double wide trailers is not uncommon. And when those floods came in, which were historic floods, they lost everything. And so some of our students that are our storytellers have lived through that. And so they are seeing this place as an opportunity to get out of poverty, to escape some of that generational, the concerns about, you know, meth and opioid addiction, drug addiction, yeah, poverty, all of those societal ills. Those are very real for us and for our students. And so having these stories of survival and of rising above these challenges is so important for others to hear. And so that's why we've started to house them and to be very intentional about saving these stories for our current students, as well as for other future students as well.
Well, it seems like there's a connection. What we were talking about before is, like, you know, storytelling for, like, leaders. But I think, like, everybody can become, like, their own, like, leader. You know, like, you can create all these micro businesses today where you don't necessarily have to work for the, you know, Madison Avenue or work for the corporate world. There's a lot of people, right, that start to learn how to use their voice. And it's like a sales pitch for you. Like, you learn how to, like, tell your story, and then that might evolve to, you know, what you want to do in life. And then, that's, if you, right, tell that story enough times, you can, like, it self-actualize. You can actually, like, well, I want to do this, and I'm going to speak to this. And I come from a Buddhist perspective. Like, if we actually say it, we can make it happen. But a lot of people, what, they'll ask foo-foo. It's like, no, but if you actually practice in that way, you start to find that you actually can do that.
Yeah. And the stories really give meaning to our experiences and meaning to our work. I will never forget, for a period of time, I had stepped out of superintendency, which, if you don't read code, that means I was fired. And so I was out looking for a job after being a superintendent in a district in Illinois outside of Chicago. And I ended up getting a job at GE Security, which was a General Electric business. And I had never worked for corporate America. I just came out of public education. It was my entire career, except for those 3 years. And this was from 2006 to 2009. And so I worked with school districts as the education vertical marketing manager, school districts across the country to keep schools safe and secure, of course, using GE technology. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a fancy way of saying that we sold stuff out of boxes, out of trunks. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but we were there to sell stuff. But every time we went down to Bradenton, Florida, which was the headquarters for GE Security at the time, the CEO of the business always reminded us that while we may be selling stuff out of boxes, what we were really doing was keeping the world safe. Keep in mind, this is 2006, just 5 years after 9/11. And so everyone had jumped into that space. And while that's maybe more of an example of keeping the vision and the mission in mind, maybe more so than a full-blown story, the outcome was the same. It gave meaning to our work. And that's what stories do.
Yeah, I mean, because like if you're going to be a salesperson or you're going to work in any job, if you can tell a compelling story that's not just about moving a widget, like if you just say, well, like we got to move these widgets because we need to make a profit, well, that's not very compelling and people are probably going to just like, whatever, I don't need to hear that. But if you tell them, well, this widget is actually going to protect you, it's going to make you feel secure, if you're going to tell a story that it's going to make you help you, then that's kind of like the lesson. So you start to frame it like an author, like a writer. Like, and you plan it and you're looking for the outcome like a professor. It's like, what is the lesson that the student's going to give you back in the blue book, right? Like you put out the lesson all semester long, and when they come back and they write it in the blue book, what did they take from that? Can they kind of do the Socratic method and apply it, and actually not just multiple choice, but really apply it and use it? If you can help people learn how to help themselves, to take what you learned. I think that's what the story, the kind of oral history of teaching has always been about, like telling that story and showing you how to learn. But like the act of learning is through somebody like you telling a story and the student figuring out, oh, these are the core things I need to get out of this and learn how to apply it.
Yeah. And for businesses, for business people, you know, if you're a customer and you need to buy a widget, You could buy from a million different people, but why would they buy that widget from you? And the reason they will do that is because there's something about you, whether they can relate to an experience or there's something in your background, through a story, if you can demonstrate that you understand their concerns, their challenges, their problems, you're going to be more engaging. They're going to remember you. That's one of the. That's the other thing that stories do. As a speaker, stories make you memorable. If you just talk about your background, your experiences, and like you know, you got a PowerPoint screen behind you, you got the bullet points, where you went to school, you know what you're doing. If they even paid attention to the PowerPoint screen, they will not remember anything two slides later. But by telling a story, a well-developed, well-crafted story, it makes you memorable. And that's one of the things that I tell my students, my college students, because mostly I teach graduate students who are preparing to be principals and superintendents. But the real fun that I've had is teaching an undergraduate management for non-business majors. And so most of my students, my undergrads, which are face-to-face, tend to be aviation students, construction management, exercise sports science, or a variety of other majors, but not business. And I tell them, here is where you're going to use storytelling, because maybe they're going to graduate within 6 months, maybe they're younger and maybe years, but at some point they're going to be sitting in an interview. And in that interview, the interviewer is going to ask, give me an example of, or tell me a time when. What that person is asking for is a story. And as a job candidate, as a prospect, if you have, again, a handful of stories that you can adapt for almost any situation, you will become memorable. They will remember you. And the other thing that stories do is, I think it's the power of stories, gives you credibility. Because you can say that you are Superman, Superwoman, Super whoever, but by telling a story, you're giving evidence. You're demonstrating your commitment to a philosophy. You're showing it, not just talk. It's not just blah, blah, blah. You're actually demonstrating that commitment. You're demonstrating that experience because of the story that you're sharing.
I think it's really important that you mentioned, like, they have people use so many tools, like they'll go and use the PowerPoint, they'll use whatever, you know, kind of fancy, like, get the gadgets to, like, try to push the story. But the, really what's important is in the elevator pitch that you're making to that HR person, why would they hire you above anybody else? Like, if everybody's got the same SATs, they got this, they came, all came from the same companies, they all have the same skill sets, what about you is going to bring something to the organization where you're going to want to keep me, where you're going to want me to be in there? What am I going to bring to the table? But you got to tell that story, because all your factual stuff on your resume and all the stuff they can look up, well, there's everybody they're probably talking to has that. Like, why? You've got to make yourself stand out with that story.
That's right. Your story distinguishes you. Your story makes you stand out because no one else has your story. And probably most of the others are not going to tell a story.
Yeah.
I mean, you come in, you swoop.
You swoop in.
With a great story, and you're the person they remember.
Well, it kind of shows you can think on your feet, you know, because the hard question, I've been in corporate stuff. I've been in corporate world software design for 25 years. And they always ask you, like, how did you handle, like, what's your failure? They always want to find out how you're going to talk about a failure, or what was, like, how did you, like, deal with this adverse situation? And it's hard for some people to come up with, well, they don't want to look like they did something wrong or they made a mistake. But that's, like, you know, in software design, everything we do, a lot of what we do is happy accidents, you know, and this is the same thing in, like, scientific world or chemistry or mathematics. A lot of times, sometimes we'll find something by accident that wasn't in the plan. And being able to take that thing that happened kind of point in time, happened by accident, and actually be able to step up and say, hey, this wasn't in the plan, but this is a better opportunity than what we're doing. This actually could help the company more. And having the kind of guts to actually say that. And if you can kind of show that you can think on your feet and you can take an opportunity when it comes to you, that you can bring it up and you can let everybody know about it, that's like a story that you can tell. And I've actually told that story, got jobs because I told that story.
It works. It absolutely works. Stories, you know, stories can also be very, very motivating as well. Again, it's just, but the key is they're true personal stories. But I remember an individual who I found extremely motivating because when I was in high school and college, I did nothing athletic, nothing at all. The newspaper journalism was my sport. So I've saved my body for the later years. And now I run marathons. And I typically run the Chicago Marathon. And the path, the race course, goes through a Lincoln Park neighborhood in front of it's like an assisted living place for senior citizens. And at that point, I don't know, I was 8, 9, 10 miles into the race. And I'm tired at that point. But there was an older woman who was standing up carrying a sign that was just made out of cardboard, and a marker, and it said, "You've got what it takes." And it was just this little moment of inspiration and motivation that helped get me past there. And then the next year I'm looking for her, and I see her again, same spot, same assisted living center. It's great. Third year, well, she's getting older now. And this time she wasn't standing. She was still there with her sign, but she was seated in the bus shelter outside the assisted living residence. And every time I went by her, it was this moment of energy, this little burst of energy. And then after a few years, I stopped seeing her. And I don't know where, you know, I'm assuming she probably passed away, because otherwise she would have been out there. Yeah. But I still get that motivation when I go past that same building, that same spot, that same bus shelter where she used to be seated. And, you know, and so when I talk to people about motivational events, about finding that motivation, finding that energy, finding that drive, that's a story that I kind of share with people too.
Well, that is a real tangible moment that people, I think, can feel that. They can feel the kind of, if you tell a story that kind of pulls at the heartstrings, that kind of, that pulls at somebody's emotion, then they're more likely to remember it than some logical exercise, which, you know, as a writer, you start to figure that out.
Exactly. And I even fill in some more details on that story too, because as I go by that, not only do I see the older woman standing outside in front, but they had all these windows. And so you had all the senior citizens who couldn't make it out in the cool October morning, you know, cheering us on. And I would imagine my grandmother, who was always my biggest cheerleader. I'd always imagine her there in one of those windows. Crowd, of course, she wasn't, but the association that I would make and still make when I go through that place now. But you're right. That's the emotional piece. That's, I think, probably the key, as well as the descriptions, the details that you provide. But it's also an emotional element too, and that's real important to storytelling, even in business.
Yeah, that's like one thing I started to ask this question as we probably get to close out. One of the last questions I always ask a guest is like, "What are three things about you that folks should know that they maybe wouldn't expect based on what we've been talking about, like wouldn't expect about you?"
Well, certainly most people would never guess that I'm an athlete, that I run marathons. I started, I guess, when I was 48, just because I had nothing better to do on a particular Sunday morning. And so I thought, well, running a marathon sounds interesting. So I've done that a dozen times, and now I'll be running three marathons this year, Illinois and Champaign-Urbana in April, and then Berlin in September, and Chicago again in October. But I'm going to be prepared this time, because one of my students from the last semester is a cross-country runner here on scholarship from Kenya. So if I cannot be a Kenyan runner, I can be trained by a Kenyan runner. So that's the first thing.
Yeah, it's really, that's always key.
Yeah. I used to live in Brazil. I did a study abroad in graduate school and came back married from that experience. Got a couple of kids. And having struggled through foreign languages in high school and college and junior high, most people would never have guessed that I would voluntarily take up a new language and start learning Portuguese, I've been speaking bad Portuguese for decades now, for probably 35, 40 years, I guess. Third thing, most people probably don't appreciate how much I love teaching higher education. And I was in public education all my life, except for the GE time. I enjoyed it. Most of my career, I was a school superintendent. So that meant I was always fighting with somebody Because every time you make a decision, there's a board member or a community member or a teacher. There's anytime you make a decision, someone's mad at you. But one of my professors from my first master's degree was a professor named Carl Kenke, and he was a reading methods professor. And he said, Ray, you should consider higher education. Well, that was very early on in my career, and I always thought about higher ed, but I could never afford it because higher ed, frankly, just doesn't pay anything. And so I had to retire out of Illinois public education, where I've got a pension to pay my bills to the day I die, because I don't want to calculate my salary here. And I've got to have an apartment. I've got to have utilities, cable, all that stuff here. And so I'm working for beer money. But as my colleague reminded me, I am not here for the job. What I'm here for is a lifestyle. And I get to teach amazing kids. I just love mm-hmm. them. It's just, and being able now to walk across campus and know kids, because like I said, most of my graduate students, they're teachers. They're going to be principals. They're never on campus. The graduate part is virtual asynchronous. So I may never see my students until graduation, but my undergrads, I see them all the time. And I love that. And now I get to do research, and I get to write articles and books, and it's just wonderful. The hardest transition for me coming to higher education was that I always thought reading and writing, if I did that during the day at work as a superintendent, it was like I was cheating. I wasn't working. Here, they pay me to do that. That's part of the expectation. Yeah. And so it's just wonderful.
Well, it's great to be in the kind of atmosphere where you're continually learning, and you're in that kind of, you know, that collegial environment. Like this, when you're a creative person or a person that wants to learn, if you're in a place where that's happening, like where people are coming up with the ideas, people are coming up with the research, they're coming up with the articles, they're writing books. It just feels good if that's where your head's at. If you're a person that is into, I like to create, I like to research, I like to know, I like to learn. I know I don't know everything, I want to learn more. And I think that's, and then to be able to pass on your expertise to other people, that's always great. You know, to be a teacher, to be a mentor, I think that's something we love to talk to people who do that. That's one of the reasons why we talk to you, why you're on the show today.
Yeah, that's what's going to keep you young.
Yeah, well, I think it does keep you young because, it's just, I think to realize you have a lot to learn and to realize that there are lessons learned. And I think that's where people, you know, we realize like if you make a mistake or you have a happy accident, that's not the end of the world. That you can recover from that and actually grow from that. And I think that's like the great lesson that you can, you know, get out of life is like, you don't have to be perfect, but you can strive for where to try to learn to be better than you were the day before. You know, I think that's
right.
And all you can try to do.
That's right. And that's what matters. You know, we're all going to trip up. We're all human. But it's what we learn from it, how we change from that experience, and then how we share it as a story.
So thank you again for being on the show. It's always great. We've had some comments from people who've been with us, and I do appreciate all the people who listen and watch the show. And again, thank you for being on the show. This will be on, we were on YouTube, Twitch, and Facebook. We'll be on many other podcast platforms. Everywhere you can listen or watch a podcast, you'll get that information tomorrow to share with your students and audience. But again, thank you for being a guest on the PM Electric Ghost podcast.
Thanks so much, Phantom. I've had a great time. I enjoyed it. Thanks so much.